Yesterday was the beginning of the commemoration of 87 years since Kristallnacht. Unfortunately, it went on for 2 days, so today it continues to be the anniversary. And survivors are quoted in a recent article in the Times of Israel of saying it seems ominously familiar, the current goings on that we are living through right now, as to what they experienced then 87 years ago. Shuls are again under attack, hatred is spreading faster than ever, and the lessons of the past are becoming very, very relevant all over again. There are many who say it's kind of hauntingly similar to the way it was in 1938. And yeah, we all need to be reminded that how quickly prejudice can turn into persecution. So to talk to me about that this afternoon is what is a man of many talents. He's a tech entrepreneur, he's a startup advisor, but I think many of us know him as a global Jewish advocate. He is Hillel Fuld, and what a privilege it is to talk to you on Chai FM this afternoon, Hillel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So survivors of Kristallnacht are saying that the world is entering an era equivalent to 1938. And I'm interested to know whether, from your perspective, do you see parallels between then and now?
Well, I don't know if what I think matters. Why don't we look at Holocaust survivors who experienced that and are experiencing this? And my great aunt, Olga Kay, survived not one, not two, but three death camps. And when I interviewed her, and this is on YouTube, I asked her, you saw the anti-Semitism back then, and you see the anti-Semitism now. How do they compare? And she looked at me and answered me with two words, and she said, the same. So I don't think there's any question that if you make a list of things that the Jews had to endure before the Holocaust, whether it's, you know, the ban on academia, whether it's being harassed or assaulted on the streets, whether it's the inability to walk around, you know, with identifying objects, whether it's jewelry or other things, everything that happened back then, including the shattering of windows and Jewish institutions and everything we saw back then, with almost no exceptions, is happening now.
So I guess we need to ask the question, what then are the lessons that we can take from those events into our time now?
Well, I guess that depends how politically incorrect you want me to get. But, you know, I grew up asking...
It's our safe space. You can talk freely.
I grew up asking the question, how could it be that the German Jews didn't see the writing on the wall? I mean, it was so obvious. And I never had an answer to that question until now. Because it seems to me that the writing is all over the wall. All I'm doing is reading it out loud. And yet somehow all my friends and family and acquaintances and colleagues are sticking their head in the sand and saying, nah, it's not the same. But it is the same. And I understand that that might not be comfortable to hear. But you know what? Had I told my grandmother in 1935 to get out, she probably would have said the same thing. Stop being an alarmist. You know, you're creating hysteria. It's not so bad. But the reality is we know how this ends because it ends the same way in every generation.
You know, I've been thinking about this quite a lot myself, and I've come up with two major differences. The one that today is that your capital, you can move by pressing a button. And I think many in Germany were prisoners of capital and financial considerations. And way more important than any financial consideration is that there's a very strong Jewish state of Israel, which, I mean, it's a game changer.
Well, of course, I agree with you, but it is ironic when my friends outside of Israel and diaspora, they say to me, yeah, but we have a state of Israel. You're right, you have a state of Israel, so get on a plane and come here. I mean, yeah, of course it's different because we have the state of Israel, but if you understand that the state of Israel is what's protecting you and preventing you from, you know, enduring and experiencing what our ancestors experienced, well, then maybe it's time to get on a plane and come back to your homeland where you are protected and where there is an army to protect you. An army, by the way, that some might say, you know, had a mission that failed on October 7th. And that's an accurate statement. It is an accurate statement, but it's still an army that's dedicated to my safety and your safety. So while you're right, it is not the same because we have Israel, it is the same that diaspora Jews are sticking their head in the sand and saying, nah, it's not so bad. It is. And it's time to get on a plane.
One survivor was quoted as having said in that particular article in Times of Israel that if we see it, we have to hit back. And so I'm going to ask you, in your view, what does hitting back look like? Is that through advocacy, through education, through technology, or force? What does it look like?
Well, I mean, the big question is, if you were able to speak to my grandmother in retrospect, knowing what happened, and you were able to speak to her in 1935, and you said to her, "You got to get out of here," and she would have said to you, "I'm not running away. I'm going to fight back." Well, what would you have said to her? You would have said to her, "No, you need to leave and not fight back because what's about to happen is terrible." And so I understand the rationale of, "I'm not going to run away and I want to fight back and I want to," I get it. But again, we know how this ends. And so sometimes it's okay to be, smart or and dead or not so smart and alive. So maybe instead of staying there and saying, "I'm going to fight," maybe, open a history book and you'll see what's about to happen and maybe just get out of harm's way and come home.
Let's talk about you're a man who understands technology. That's part of your game. Digital platforms. Do you think they can be used to assist counter the growth of anti-Semitism rather than amplify them? And I'm just thinking of the Tucker Carlsons and the Nick Fuenteses and this whole new anti-Semitism that seems to be arising out of the right.
Of course. I mean, not a day goes by where I don't meet a tech company, including today, by the way, that is using technology, using AI to detect fake news, to combat fake news, to debunk lies, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it's a very big effort being made in Israel, and not only in Israel, but the reality is that our enemies are both very unified in terms of their story, and they're very clear in terms of their narrative. They have a very easy story to digest and an easy story that gets easily distributed on social media. And we can combat it, but the reality is what we really need to do is define our narrative and join together and said and spread that narrative, because that is why we're losing this PR war. Not because they outnumber us, it's because they have a clear narrative and they are unified behind that narrative. And we are anything but unified. We are fragmented, and whatever story we have, we don't tell together. So that is something we need to fix immediately.
Hillel, this links back, circles back to a conversation that we had in a previous hour with an Israeli general talking about the vote for Mamdani, the fact that 37% of young Jews in New York City voted for a candidate who was blatantly anti-opposed to the existence of the Jewish state. And one begins to wonder, is that just an absolute abject failure in education? How is it that 37% of young Americans could do that? Globalize the
Well,
Intifada. They seem to have no issue with that.
I mean, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but look at history. Open a history book. When was there ever not Jews who sided with the enemy? I mean, all the way back to biblical Egypt, 80% of the Israelites stayed back. And we see that in every generation. Of course, in Germany, we had the Kapos. We always have Jews who think mistakenly that if they side with the enemy, if they appease the enemy, then anti-Semitism will skip over them. But Hitler didn't care what you called yourself. Hitler didn't care how religious you were, and neither did the Palestinians on 10/7. They didn't care what your political opinions are. Jew haters, anti-Semites don't care what you call yourself and who you voted for. So unfortunately, this is the same mistake we make in every generation. And we always, as unfortunately, as the Jewish people, think that we can outdo our hosts. We can out America, the Americans, and become the most liberal people in America. But in reality, it doesn't work. And the more we assimilate and try to tell our hosts that we're just like them, the more they remind us that we're not.
But it is interesting to me. I mean, you've posited very firmly here this afternoon that the solution to anti-Semitism is Zionism. More specifically, it's Aliyah. It is interesting that to 37%, and that's not a small number, to 37%, that is a message that is rejected outright. And I don't know what how that recalibrates the
Again,
relationship
not something
between
new.
nothing
This is
new.
not something new. We have to remember that. People don't realize this, but we hear we read these stories again, whether it's all the way back in the Bible, to from Egypt to the desert where 10 of the heads of the tribes came and said, "No, don't go into Israel. Let's just stay here." This is not a new thing, right? They, as in Jews throughout the generations, have all the excuses in the book. By the way, some of those excuses are valid. I'm not belittling or diminishing the challenges of moving to Israel. It's not an easy thing to pick up and move your life. I get that. That being said, what I tell my friends is, if you had a gun to your head, a physical gun to your head, you would get on a plane and all of your questions would disappear. You'd have to deal with it. You'd come to Israel, you'd make a life, but you don't think that what's happening today constitutes a gun. And so I ask, what does? If what's happening today in the world doesn't constitute a gun, then I wonder, is there anything that will happen that my friends will take their heads out of the sand and get on a plane an hour ago?
It's interesting looking at it through your lens. I mean, I hear everything you're saying. I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I'm just thinking about it in the context of, say, the French Jewish community, who's had a really rough ride. I mean, France has been the first place in Europe where Jews were killed for being Jews since the Holocaust. There was a blip, there was a spike in Aliyah, but it's back to normal levels. We seem to need the comfort of our familiarity. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, you would expect the French Jewish community to be a lot smaller than it is today.
Correct. This is not a uniquely Jewish thing. Of course, as human beings, we don't like change, and I get that. But I just hope that we don't get to a point where you have a gun to your head, or worse, before you know you decide to come home. Not you, I mean, in general, Jews, not only in the U.S., in the U.K., and France, they have to open their eyes. And it's an uncomfortable reality to admit that people we once called our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues have turned on us like in every other generation. It's not an easy thing to accept, but that is the reality.
Yeah, I'm going to leave this on a lighter note this afternoon. I see on my Facebook page, for whatever reason, you're a friend of mine. I don't know how that happened. I'm glad it did, but I don't know how. I see that you were quite willing to take anybody who makes Aliyah for a shawarma.
Yeah, I've written in my posts on Aliyah at the end as a joke. I say, you know, if you come on Aliyah, shawarma's on me. But it turns out not many people didn't take it as a joke. So I'm standing behind my word, and I bought many people shawarmas already. And I hope to buy many, many more. Maybe I'll put together a shawarma fund.
You know, Phil, thank you for chatting to me this afternoon. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.